Welcome to the Literary License Podcast Retrospective as we explore anthologies. Anthologies have been around since the 1800s with classics by Poe, Hawthorne, Stevenson, and Lovecraft, to name a few. Motion pictures have been exploring anthologies since the 1930s until today, with even television using the format. Come with us as we celebrate the anthology films through the ages.
Everyone, and welcome to the Literary License Podcast. This week we're doing the anthology films. We will be discussing The House That Dripped Blood from 1971 and Asylum from 1972. Before we get started, let's see who we got with us. We have Vicky Ray with us.
Hi, guys.
And Keith Chagos with us.
Hello, everyone.
So as these films, we're probably going to have a lot to say about these. We're going to probably jump right into it. Beginning with The House That Dripped Blood, which is a 1971 British anthology horror film directed by Peter Duffel and distributed by Amicus Production. It stars Christopher Lee, Peter Cushing, Nyree Dawn Porter, Denholm Elliott, and John Pertwee, as well as Chloe Frank, so I feel should have been mentioned in this. The film is a collection of four short stories concerning a series of inhabitants in the eponymous building. All these stories were originally written and subsequently scripted by Robert Bloch, best known for Psycho. So the beginning of it, shortly after renting an old country house, film star Paul Henderson mysteriously disappears and Inspector Holloway from Scotland Yard is called to investigate. Inquiring at the local police station, Holloway is told some of the house's history. And that is going to be the crux of all these stories. I guess what we'll do now is we will cut to the trailer and be right back.
This house is full of sound. The loudest is your heart, pounding in the night. The softest is the sound of terror.
Isn't... Oh, Charles.
No, baby.
In this house, terror waits for you in every room.
Where are they? You must search the house, but you must find that doll.
Vampires, voodoo, vixens, and victims. You'll find them all in The House That Dripped Blood.
And welcome back to Literary License. We will be discussing The House That Dripped Blood. Starting with you, Vicky, what would you like to say about The House That Dripped Blood?
Well, I'm definitely not renting it as an Airbnb because you just don't ever get a fair shake in this place. Something always happens. It's horrible. Why does this guy keep renting this fucking house out? People keep dying. And he's okay with it. Here comes the next set of renters for the weekend.
Well, you notice the name of the realtor, right? Stoker.
What was it?
Stoker.
Like Brian Stoker? God, that's right. It was, wasn't it?
AJ Stoker, who's renting the house out. So you know there's going to be some fuckery and some vampirism at least. But that's a good way.
Like my favorite. Why do they say they always save the best for last in these movies? I hate that because they were all good stories, actually. But I have to admit that the cloak thing was kind of fun.
I was going to say after the last one where we did not have a lot, we didn't like a good chunk of the stories. I felt all four of these were a lot more solid.
They were all strong stories.
Yeah, like the last one.
It's just
about
they have the one common denominator, and that's the house.
Well, that's what I think makes it work, actually. Instead of having a bunch of people in a room, like, well, guess what? You're dead. I think that's what makes this work.
Yeah.
Because I like the idea that there's a ghost, I like haunted houses, but yeah. To have a house like formulate its way depending on the people who live there, I quite like that idea. That's a nice idea. You know, it'd be like the Amityville Horror. That's what they probably should have done with the Amityville Horror sequels. Like, you know, this is what happened to monsters. And then the next family move in and I sit there and say, and totally something different happens to them. You know what I mean? That would make a great anthology.
That's the great twist at the end of this. The house just reflects the people who live in it. And I
the Wax Museum one, that was so fucking creepy where she looks like somebody, you know, that's just creepy as hell. I mean, that was just so good. I mean, because that gave you the heaves, you know. That gave me the heaves anyway.
It really does. I remember the first story being one that affected me really a lot. I really enjoyed that, where you have Denholm Elliott, a pre-Marcus Brody Denholm Elliott.
Marcus Brody. That's right. I know. It's just like, oh, wow, it is. It's Marcus. I've got all excited in my seat now.
Yeah, him and his wife moving into the house. His wife is, or he starts seeing this killer, this obvious killer, because, I mean, the guy looked, what else is he going to do? When you look like that, there's only one trade you can go in, and that's murder. So, yeah, you got this guy who's kind of stalking him around the house, and the wife is, he's like, no, no, he's over there in the corner. The wife's walking towards the corner. No, don't get too close to him. But there's nobody here. That's because he's moved over there. And she's, and it's a total gaslight mystery because she's, you know, she is a, you know, she is gaslighting him. She set the whole thing up. It turns out in the twist, she has set the whole thing up to basically get him declared insane. So she could just sit there, collect the residuals from his money and run away with this actor who is under like this fake prosthetic face and everything. He's got all these prosthetics on.
So, and like Heath Ledger, he couldn't let go of the role.
Yeah.
But then he slips up because after he kills the therapist to make it look like Denholm Elliott did it, he kills Denholm Elliott too. And the wife's like, but wait a minute. Yeah. Like he said, he's like Heath Ledger. He's stuck in the role and he cannot get out of it. I really, really love that story. The Peter Cushing story with the Wax Museum is another one. Absolutely fantastic.
Oh God, that was.
I mean the
Did Neville's one is does his friend die? He spotted the sculpture, right? Neville became obsessed with it. He didn't want to leave town.
Well, he was in love with Peter Cushing's wife, wasn't he?
Yeah, that's the implication that I got from it. And this is before Peter Cushing's actual wife died, so it's weird that there's all these stories that we're getting in these movies where Peter Cushing's wife has passed away.
Yeah, he murdered him with an axe, right? Isn't that how that ended?
The guy who runs the museum murdered his wife murdered. I mean, the story basically reflects the story of Peter Cushing and his friend.
Right.
Because Peter Cushing's friend, like Keith said, obviously has a thing for his wife.
Right.
The guy who runs the wax museum caught his wife with another man and she was killing him. And then the state killed.
That's right. Okay.
Because he said the state killed my wife.
Because all the anthologies are like running into, you know, the last, this is like 8 stories. And I'm like, wrong movie.
That might be. Yeah. Well, I mean, Peter Cushing in the next one, we're going to see another grief-stricken Peter Cushing in the next movie, too.
Kind of makes you feel bad knowing that he does actually have to go through that in real life. That's rough.
Yeah, we talked about it in, I think, the Uncanny episode. Yeah. We talked about Peter Cushing, or no, it was Tales from the Crypt. Tales from the Crypt, because Peter Cushing is the grief-stricken old man who gets the Valentines that drive him to suicide. But yeah, if you haven't listened to those, Peter Cushing around this time and the interview with Sam Irvin, which is reprinted in Sam's book, he says that Sam asks him why he works so much. And he says working constantly is the best that I could do until I can be reunited with my Helen. And you feel it with all these grief-stricken characters that he's playing in these movies, even though this one in particular, his wife was very ill. But I don't think she had died yet when they were filming this. By the time we get to Asylum and Tales from the Crypt, she will have passed away. But yeah, the story kind of reflects what happened with Peter Cushing and his friend with the wax museum curator and his wife. The next one is Christmas Sweet. What's that?
The little girl, Sweets to the Sweet. Little shit.
Oh, and this is the same little girl from The Uncanny that was torturing her cousin.
She's in the same business.
The great Chloe Franks, and she's so sweet and innocent through this whole thing. And she's playing up the puppy dog eyes, and you just keep feeling sorry for her. You're like, oh, Christopher Lee is such a shit in this.
She's not allowed to have dolls. She's not allowed. Then she gets a hold of those candles. It's like, oh, fuck, I know where this is going.
Oh, yeah. I got to read this, actually. Go ahead, Keith.
Well, to be honest, if Christopher Lee wasn't being such an asshole, chances are it would have been a different ending.
Well, maybe he had to be an asshole because you couldn't trust her.
Yeah, but he couldn't trust her because the thing is, if he gave her some understanding, okay, if she has this power, obviously he's intelligent, but if she has this power, you just think that maybe if he was more of a father to her, that maybe she wouldn't have turned against him. Because, yeah. I mean, he was very cold.
Yeah, he's extremely cold. He doesn't give her any love. But, I mean, there's a reason for it because didn't he resent the mother too?
After he found out she was a witch.
Yeah, she is a witch. And then, so I guess, to me, it seems like the mother dies after giving childbirth. She was a witch. So he was doing everything in his power to prevent her from becoming a witch, which pushed her more into being a witch. You know, is that classic thing?
Well, she's very good at it, because I wish I could just melt wax down and fuck with people like she did. Mm. You know, it's just like, that's just a gift.
But he kind of I kind of watched it thinking he kind of deserved it.
Yeah.
Well, he is kind of cruel. He's a cruel person, but he didn't love the mom. Why was he with the mom? Was he just enchanted with her? I mean, he hates his offspring too.
He says he didn't know initially what she was. So I guess that's why. I mean, she's probably a really beautiful woman that, you know. Yeah.
That's what they usually happen.
I think he says she was quite beautiful. I think he says at one point. So in his book, I Was a Teenage Monster Hunter, Sam Irvin does interview Chloe Franks. He interviews Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing a bunch of times, but this movie never came up when discussing them. But when he asked her about any on-set memories, she says, yes, in The House That Dripped Blood, Christopher Lee throws a voodoo doll into the fire and the smell was awful. It was really terrible. I was making dreadful faces because of it. They had many dolls in case they had to retake the scene. After everybody smelled how awful the first take was, they left it as it is and they gave me all the dolls to take home. So yeah, that scene where he burns the doll.
Early. You know, I've heard stories about Christopher Lee and about how he can be quite difficult.
Yeah.
I wonder if he's always, and the thing is, he always kind of plays that horrible dickhead kind of a guy. I'm wondering if he was just being typecasted.
Possibly.
Yeah, he's always the very stuffy, you know, Englishman. Overbearing.
But even Dracula, he's stuffy and like that.
Well, it says that he's arrogant in Bram Stoker's book because, you know, he's been around for 400, 500, 600 years. So he's always going to be stuffy and with the aquiline nose and look down upon the peasants.
I mean, have you ever seen Christopher Lee smile on anything?
I have, actually.
I have, yeah. I got to think on it, though.
What was the name of the movie? Because I keep getting the song stuck in my head. He does a musical number. Captain Invincible. The Return of Captain Invincible, where he's the villain in that. And Alan Arkin is playing this superhero who is an alcoholic. And several years later, he comes back and Christopher Lee, as the villain, does this great musical number called Name Your Poison or Pick Your Poison. I don't remember, but it's
Isn't he in Monster Party too? Isn't he in Monster Party?
Oh, no, not that I know of. I don't know a movie called Monster Party that he's in.
Mm.
Another quick thing here. When Sam asks Chloe about the House of Drip Blood, Christopher Lee, with whom I had worked with twice, was very nice. He's a very good actor. She was 10 when she, she was like 10, I think, when she did this interview. This interview was right after the movie came out. I liked the director of The House of Trip Blood very well. I think his name was Peter Duffel. Nyrene Don Porter was very nice to me. Peter Cushing visited the set one day, and I thought he was very nice. So yeah, not a lot. She's a little girl just saying how nice everybody is. So
what monster story were they all in? It was called Monster Something. Vincent Price. What am I thinking of?
You're probably thinking of, well, we're thinking Vincent Price, Peter Cushing.
It was comedic. And they were all in it together, and I cannot think of the name of it.
It's all in a house, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the House of Long Shadows. It's Vincent Price.
But he smiles in that.
Vincent Price, Christopher Lee, John Carradine, and Peter Cushing are in that.
Didn't they have Desi Arnaz in it as well?
Desi Arnaz Jr. is in it. Yeah.
Arnaz Jr. Yeah.
Which, hell, we should do that as a make remake, because we could do the original Seven Keys to Bald Pate and then the House of Long Shadows. I see.
But Kate, he smiled for that one. That's the point. I was thinking of Monster Party for some reason, but he smiled for that one for some reason.
So there's one movie out of 760.
Well, there's one. Actually, I should Google it. Movies that Christopher Lee smiled.
I know the guy had a really high opinion of himself, but when you consider he was a hunter of Nazi war criminals. He fought in World War II. Ian Fleming is his cousin, and he said that he based the James Bond character on Christopher Lee.
Like, did he really? I never heard that before.
Apparently, yeah. He based
the character.
Knighted by the Queen of England. Like the guy, like I, if I had all those accolades, I'd probably be really full of myself too.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
And we talk about this every time we have Christopher Lee in any movie. He kind of big timed everyone in the 70s when he went to Hollywood, and because he felt like he should be, you know, like
a great leading man.
And he was like, he was stuck in all these monster movies. Then when he got to Hollywood, he was refusing to do all these monster movies. Suddenly he's finding himself not getting a lot of the work that he wants either. And it isn't until he embraced it in the late 90s, he embraced that that's what made him famous, that suddenly he had a little bit of a resurgence. Suddenly, you know, because Tim Burton used him in Sleepy Hollow, and Burton was like, oh my God, no, we all grew up on your movies. And now all of a sudden Christopher Lee's like, wait a minute. So Peter Jackson and Steven Spielberg and George Lucas and Tim Burton and all these top directors, they want to use me because of the monster pictures. And he had a little bit of a resurgence.
Smiling.
There he is.
Smiling anyway, Keith. Look, he's smiling.
She found a picture of him smiling.
It's like watching Wednesday Addams smiles. Like, I'm scared.
I can't find any movie where he's smiling, so they other something.
Well, he's usually the villain. So
it's kind of hard.
He's usually a villain in most of his movies, so yeah. It's kind of hard to find him smiling. He's always very, but yeah, he's got a manga in The Man with the Golden Gun. So there's, yeah, he had a great career of just playing mostly villains, and that is Sweets to the Sweet. But yeah, Chloe Franks is so adorable in this, and she's so like
innocent looking.
Yeah, you can see why Nyrene Don Porter is so taken by her and like falls into the trap. But also, like Keith said, if Christopher Lee wasn't such a dick to her, she probably wouldn't be this way. She'd probably use her powers for good for him.
Maybe make him rich or whatever. But yeah, I guess you could look at it that way.
Well, because the thing is, she's not evil, because if she was evil, then she would have turned it on her governess.
Yeah, and she does. She
likes the governess. That's true.
The governess is kind to her and shows her love and compassion. So
he doesn't want her to have any dolls because he worries that she's going to make a voodoo doll of him. Well, if you didn't treat her like shit, she wouldn't be making a voodoo doll of you.
Precisely.
There has to be a backstory we're not aware of.
I mean, the backstory is just, you know, they go into it a little bit with Nyrene Don Porter as the governess saying, asking, did you resent the wife? And he said he was quite taken by her until he found out what she was. So it sounds like he's just really judgmental. Finds out his wife's into witchcraft, and instead of being like, well, oh, cool, look, I love you, we're gonna have to disagree on this, he's like, no, you're scum. Like, that's kind of the idea that I got of it.
Yeah, it's what happens when you live in a black and white world.
But I will think of, go away from the stories and think of what's his name, Holloway, the guy he's telling about the house and the stories too. I mean, how is he really incredulous about the whole thing? He doesn't want to believe that any of this stuff happened.
He'll find out.
Oh, yeah. But I mean, what hell will he find? I would not go in that house. No.
Well, I mean, he's the cop investigating the disappearance. He has to go in that house. He doesn't have a choice.
I reckon.
But then again, I think if you're a man, if you're a person of clean conscience, then you probably could live in the house quite well.
Well, yeah, it has to be something that's bothering you, doesn't it? So,
yeah.
Well, I mean, I don't know if Denholm Elliott's character has any conscience issues. It's his wife, if anything.
It's his wife. But that's the problem. It's the wife, isn't it? But that's probably, I mean, if you look at the stories themselves, I mean, the house just seems to draw people. I mean, the people were bad anyway when they moved in the house.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing.
And the house isn't making them bad. It's just, I think they were already bad and they just happened to, the house.
It just exacerbates the situation, maybe.
Except in Denholm Elliott's case, I think it wasn't him. I think it was just the wife. The wife's a bad person.
Yeah.
I think he just got caught up in it because I don't remember any, unless you guys caught something I did, I don't remember anything necessarily bad that Denholm Elliott's character did.
No, I mean, he was a hack writer, but that's about it.
That's not a crime.
No, it's not a crime, but I'm saying that.
I suppose in that case, he does get his comeuppance because he gets it in kind of like this old-timey, you know, hack story way of, oh, the wife killed the husband for the money. So I guess maybe that's it.
Yeah, so I guess in that way,
I guess in that way, yeah, that's the way he got it. But I don't think that's like, speaking as a hack writer myself, I don't think that's necessarily that big a crime to warrant being killed over. At least I hope not, because then
which one?
Being a hack writer.
Oh no! God.
I mean, the thing is, it just seems the house. I mean. It's just that it seems like a house that just kind of draws people there. But I mean, like the Peter Cushing story, I mean, he's not bad. She's not really bad. It's just the guy who comes to visit him is bad, you know?
So it just and that kind of dooms him. Yeah.
It just seems like bad things just happen. And they might probably, and it can all be looked at just coincidences.
And then,
even with the next story with John Pateway, Doctor Who, buying the cloak, well, the house didn't make him buy the cloak. His arrogance made him buy the cloak because he was an asshole. He wasn't an
unsure. He wanted to look good as a Dracula and it had to be the perfect cloak, right? It had to be.
Yeah, but look at the way he was treating people on the set.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah, he is kind of a douche canoe.
He's kind of a douchebag. And he's trying to bang Ingrid Pitt, let's face it.
I mean, looking like that, how can he bang?
She's pretty. I mean, yeah.
She's stunning.
There's nothing wrong with her.
Yeah, she has a nice
little Dracula herself. I was surprised she was giving him the time of day, though, with the way she looked. Oh, you know.
But she has that has that face of the cat who drank the cream kind of look to her face.
Kind of.
Didn't she? She's got this like devilish kind of really gorgeous face about her. But it's an odd looking face, but she's still gorgeous.
Yeah.
She's different looking, but beautiful.
Yeah, and if you've seen The Vampire Lovers and Countess Dracula, right. She is seductive as hell in those movies.
Yeah.
She just got something about her that's unusual and beautiful at the same time.
It's this otherworldly, like Eastern European look to her.
Yeah, it's not American, really, is it?
She is Eastern European, isn't she? So.
Yeah, well, yeah, she was German, I think. I think she was German or something like that.
What was her last name?
Pitt, P-I-T-T. I don't know what her. Well, let's see. What's her real name?
So, I mean, she's stunning. And I like the cloak story as well. I mean, that was a nice twist. The vampire story.
Yeah.
She's Polish. Her real name was Ingushka Petrov, which you could see why it's Ingrid Pitt.
Yeah. So she's Polish. She would take five of her to screw in a light bulb.
That's mean. Don't even do that. I wonder how the Polish took it. Why did they get them that rap of being stupid? Because I don't know.
I don't know.
They're all smart.
And that's the thing. I don't know.
I have no idea.
Maybe Rob Reiner. Stupid. I mean, he is stupid. I get that. But I mean, he's the only one that I've ever heard anybody call Olak. I've never heard
I think it's just
Archie Bunker back in the day.
But I think it's just like immigrants moving, because I mean, then there's, you know, the other ones, Italians or what? Right,
well, Italians used to get theirs, the Irish, everybody's got
Spanish for this, or what they call Spanish spics, and so on and so forth. Yeah. I mean, they're not
Italians, was Dagos. Dagos, WAPs.
We were Dagos, we were WAPs, we were.
There's
Guineas.
Other. Yeah, Guineas.
Guineas. They called us Guineas. Well, Guineas for
guinea pig. I didn't feel the guinea part, though.
Guinea pig, because we could be talked into anything, because when we were coming over. When we were coming over to the country, they all had the guinea pigs do it, because we were.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Start for work.
Offensive.
Start for work. So they would be like, no, have them do it. We should probably cut all that out.
Probably.
No, but I mean,
everybody knows we're kidding.
Well, I mean, if we all know that, basically. I mean, we don't use those terms anymore, but it's interesting.
I don't use those terms.
But they're all like, but they're always about like people coming over and stealing our jobs. It all comes from that. So
that's always been the fear of immigration. Is they're going to come over and steal our jobs? They're going to come over and steal our jobs. They're going to come over and steal our jobs.
Because everyone wants to work at Starbucks. Yeah. Everyone wants to work in fast food. They're taking our fast food jobs away. They're cleaning our
that's derogatory.
Cleaning our streets. Only I really want that job.
The great comedian Doug Stanhope had a bit on that. He's like. He's like, you know, if somebody coming over to your country who could barely speak your language is just as qualified for your job as you are, then you are a loser of such epic proportions that it doesn't even merit speaking about. I don't know. It's up to Keith if he wants to cut that stuff out. But yeah, going back to the cloak, Keith was saying it's a nice take on the vampire story, and I kind of cut you off with Ingrid Pitt's real name, so.
Yeah, I mean, I think
Petra, that was her last name, right? Petra.
Yeah.
And that's what I quite liked about this one. I mean, I have to sit there and say that all these stories are, except for the cloak, are taken from the horror comic book stories.
Yeah, Weird Tales.
Weird Tales and things like that. And I have to sit there and say, if you look at the two from last week, this one is far superior. It all hangs.
Yes.
And Robert Bloch wrote these stories.
I think he wrote the next one
from the last month, but he did a lot better job in these ones.
Maybe he was just finding his groove, you know?
Well, I think what happened is that I think that these are stronger stories. I also think that making them stories that are all set into a house with different case files, I think makes it work a lot better. You know, the framework works about the guy who's like, oh, I need to get into the house. Da, da, da. He goes, well, do you want to get in the house? Because this is what's happened in the house.
I just don't understand why people want to go to the house and the stories when they find out it's not very good house to go to, but they go.
Listen, I would buy the Amityville Horror House sold for $80,000. I'd buy it.
If I had the money to buy the Amityville Horror House, I'd turn it into a museum to what happened and make my money back instantly.
Yeah, the problem basically is if you look at the original wallpaper and the original carpet, and then you take all the drugs that Ronald DeFeo does, you probably end up killing a family in there too. Because, yeah, like polka dotted, like what was it? Like polka dotted wallpaper against like zigzag carpet.
It was the 70s and late latter 60s.
I know, but
it was awful stuff back then.
Yeah, but I'll take a bunch of acid and sit in that room and just tell me you're not going to be hearing voices.
We were talking about this with when Vicky was asking about the difference between Hammer and Amicus films. We were talking, yeah, just the Amicus films are set in the modern time, and the modern time is the '60s and seventies, and you have this hideous motif inside all these houses.
It's the sunflower and the greens and the mauves, the pinks and the orange.
Like, not so much in this one though, because in this one
kind of gritty. This film is kind of gritty, don't you think? I mean, I guess I'm just used to the Hammer films are pretty. I said that before. These are not pretty like the Hammer film.
Well, I think what makes this work, actually, is that...
But it works.
I think but it makes it cheaper, but which is not quite good, because this is a good, cheap way of doing it, but everything's set in the house.
Yeah.
That's true. You don't have to really worry about more sets, do you?
No, so that
it's very rare that they venture outside the house for any reason. You got the wax museum. You have these, which, you know, is an easy set to put together if you have a soundstage with a lot of dummies. You have the psychiatrist.
I think the soundstage for the cloak and the wax museum probably are all done in the same stage.
Yeah, I mean, it's all done. I think this is a Shepparton.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, because you have the reveal at the end of the cloak when he puts on the cloak and nothing happens, and he looks and goes, "Property of Shepparton Studios." Wait, this isn't my cloak. And the twist is that Countess Dracula, Elizabeth Bathory, Carmilla Karnstein herself, Ingrid Pitt, who played all those characters in previous films, she's got the real cloak, and she just wanted to make you one of us. We love your movie so much. Yeah. We just want to make you one of us. And if I ever had Ingrid Pitt in that low-cut dress looking at me, bangs bared, ready to make me immortal, I'd be like, baby, do it. Yeah. I am yours forever. I could be with her for an eternity.
She is unusually beautiful in this. A lot of them, I mean, all the girls are different looking, though, in these films, though. They're not from here, I guess. So they have more ethnic.
Well, Nyrene Dawn.
Tendencies.
Nyrene Dawn Porter in Sweets to the Sweet, she's more the traditional, you know, pretty, but, you know, kind of almost matronly, you know, pretty blonde. So she looks kind of like Ingrid Pitt just looks exotic. She just looks beautiful.
She does. There's just something unusual about her. I noticed that. I couldn't stop watching her because she was kind of fascinating to watch that in a weird way.
Everything about
just
her.
Just her mannerisms. And she was just unique.
Yeah. Absolutely gorgeous. Absolutely stunning. Absolutely unique of an actress. You could see why they always have. Like, this is the fourth movie I know of where she played a vampire. Vampire Lovers, Countess Dracula. Oh, and this. So this is at least the fourth.
Polish and Romania are not that far away from each other.
Yeah.
Each other.
Technically not.
So, yeah, you can definitely see
Romanian men tend to have unibrows, but that's about it.
But, yeah, you can see why she would be kind of like the sex symbol, because she is just absolutely stunning. So, originally, Freddie Francis was supposed to be the director of this, and that fell through. He had prior commitments to go be a DP on stuff in Hollywood. Peter Duffel wanted to have the title Death and the Maiden, but Milton Subotsky said, "We're in the marketplace. We're in the marketplace. We have to use that title." Not what else was it? What else? Critical reception. Roger Greenspun from the New York Times wrote in a mixed review that he was of several minds about the film, calling the first two stories as dull in development as they are in idea.
Yeah.
But the latter two stories, though, necessarily too short and too schematic.
Are these like the first of Amicus films starting? Are these some of the first films?
No, this was like 6 years into the run. The first we watched last month with Dr. Terror's House of Horrors. The first two were Dr. Terror's House of Horrors and the second one we did last week. Torture Garden.
Okay.
Torture Garden and Dr. Terror.
I mean, you would have thought this was at the beginning, but it's not. And that's what's amazing, because this is far superior than what we saw last week.
I think. Yeah, it is a little more tighter.
Yeah. I mean, we, when we get to the next one, we get Jesus in the insane asylum, you know.
I mean, they had at this point, this was them coming into their own. Unfortunately, this period does not last long because the decline was not too far away for these movies. This is the peak. These two and probably Tales from the Crypt. And then it starts to kind of decline, although I like the other films. But then you see by the time we get to like The Uncanny, which is technically not Amicus. But if you watch some of the...
If it's not Amicus?
It's independent.
Oh, he just by that point, Milton Subotsky and Max J. Rosenberg went their own separate ways.
Okay, because I was just wondering about that. I thought it was Amicus for some reason.
And by the time you get to the Monster Club, as much as I love it, the Monster Club, you have all these cheap Halloween masks and stuff like that. So you start to see it's a very noticeable decline in budget, at the very least in budget, because this had. Actually, I don't know who distributed this in the United States. I know my DVD is Lionsgate, but Lionsgate was not around in the 70s. Yeah, I don't know. I'll look it up later. But
yeah, I really like this one, actually. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, this is a really solid anthology movie. All the stories are good. I like the framing story. And like Keith said at the beginning, this was different because it wasn't the you know, I said when we started these, we're going to have that kind of samey twist on a lot of them of you get everybody in the room and then at the end it's real, aha, you were all dead all along and this is actually hell.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen in this one, thankfully.
And this felt a bit more, I think because it's set in the house, it just feels a bit more like more complete. It doesn't feel so, it didn't feel like so separated stories.
Yeah.
Kind of ran together quite well.
There's a through line through them, yeah. And also, here's the box. When I first watched this, I rented the VHS tape at the video store, and it was shortly after Pat Riley had just left the Knicks for the Miami Heat. And my cousin and I, and actually it's his birthday, I got to text him today. We saw that. We saw Peter Cushing's head. I didn't know who Peter Cushing was, but we felt he looked a lot like Pat Riley. We were like, yeah, God, it looks like Pat Riley gets his head cut off. Let's rent this. So yeah, that got us. This is the first of its kind that I'd seen, like the first like British anthology horror that I'd seen. So it opened up a new world for me, and I'm glad I watched it.
It was thought provoking. I thought it was cool.
I like it. It's a lot of fun. I've always liked it. I disagree with that critic who said that the first two stories are boring. I
could see if you're not into the genre though, or you're not into these specific actors or what's going on. I could see where you might almost be bored. You gotta like what you're watching. I mean, if you might not even be a fan of horror, you know.
I mean, it's also a time period where I think a lot of these critics were just like the newspaper that they work for is just like, you got to go see this movie, this movie, this movie, this movie.
Oh, I bet.
Whereas now critics seem to be like kind of split up. Like you don't send the same critic to everything. You got a guy, you know, like you'll have sites like Bloody Disgusting and Fangoria and they'll cover the horror stuff. And it'll usually be somebody who's bound to like most horror anyway. And we'll see it when they don't like it. But
right.
I think that's why now when you look at Rotten Tomatoes, horror movies and superhero movies and things that 50 years ago would have been, you know, would have gotten a lower rating are now getting a higher rating than they're used to. It's because they realize I'm not going to send the same guy to watch Citizen Kane as I would to send, you know, to watch Wolfman. And I think that's why there's kind of like this discrepancy now in criticism. But yeah. I liked it. I guess we should rate the movie, I guess, starting with you, Vicky.
Oh, I'll give it a 4.5. Easy. It didn't really lose. I had to watch it because if I got up and left, like say for a bathroom break, if I didn't stop it, I didn't know what was going on. Only for that reason, because usually I can run and I know what's going on. Couldn't do that with this movie. But I mean, it was really thought engaging. I love the fact that, you know, this guy just keeps renting out this house of death to everybody. But apparently they all have issues. But who doesn't have issues? So you're going to die no matter what.
Basically,
he has an issue, you know?
And yeah, that's the big twist at the end is that John Pertwee was made into a vampire when the cop Holloway goes into the house.
Right.
He goes down there and, you know, he is bitten by the vampires and cuts right to the sign outside. With the guy standing outside in front of the sign that says AJ Stoker Realty. I'm like, okay, Stoker. So that it kind of hammers.
That didn't even just jive with me until you said it was Stoker. I didn't even think to like over my head. But I mean, they were great stories. You know, they were fun.
They really were. I enjoyed all four. I'm glad.
They were all tight stories.
But I think it also comes because I think that they also come from the classic horror comic book as well. I think that helps. Because Tales of the Crypt has really strong stories, and they're all from the Tales from the Crypt comic book as well.
I was going to say, I thought there was, I didn't know that. So was this where Tales of the Crypt evolved?
This is from Weird Tales.
From Weird Tales. But does that what this evolves into?
Well, Tales of the Crypt was its own comic book series. So They took the stories from the comic book series, the horror comic books. They got banned eventually, and that went into the Tales of the Crypt movie. Then, of course, later on, that became the census for the TV series.
But I mean, I think not Robert Block, Milton Subotsky loved those old comics, so that's what we're seeing. That's what we're going to see with this.
You don't see any of that
stuff. We got another Amicus film, was it Vault of Horror, which plays a lot better.
We're going to be doing that, I think, this season too, aren't we?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think this sometime.
I think it's on the list.
I was talking to Keith the other day. There's been a very Peter Cushing heavy season because
it's
of all
the. It's been a very Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee kind of year. I don't see a downside to that, though.
Christopher Lee, not as much, because Christopher Lee was just, I think this is only the second one, right?
With Christopher Lee? Well, third. Second.
Because he was in Dr. Terror's House of Horrors. And he's
Peter
Cushing's
stories are always strong, though.
Because he's just such a great actor. And I think that he never got to do he should have.
Yeah. And Peter Cushing's stories are strong. So, you know, when he pops up, you know, it's going to be a strong story.
So, Keith, how would you rate this one?
I give it a 4.5. I loved it. I thought it flowed well. I really enjoyed it. If you didn't listen to it and I sit there and say that you mind or you ran off to whatever, you'd have to pause it. And I had to.
You can't leave this movie. You don't know what's going on. Mm-hmm.
You have to pay attention to it, which is a good sign as well. And I was fully interested in that. So,
and myself, I'm giving it a 5. I don't know if that's, you know, everyone else seems to give it a 4.5. So I don't think I'm that far off. Maybe the extra half stars for just the nostalgia factor for me, because I want
to sound.
I watch this movie a lot, and I've had it in various forms. Absolutely adore this movie. It's one of my favorite of the Amicus movies. As is the next one, which I guess we'll go right into now.
As is the next one.
I picked these movies out because I adore them, and they're not always hits. You know, we saw that with Torture Garden, where it was like all one story that basically carried it through. But we're getting to like the real meat of the series here, where we're getting like these great stories in every one of them. So, Asylum I should point out, also known as House of the Crazies. That's what it was released at in the United States, is a 1972 British anthology film made by Amicus Productions. The film was directed by Roy Ward Baker and produced by Milton Subotsky. Robert Block wrote the script, adapting 4 of his own short stories. Baker had considerable experience as a director of horror films, having made Quatermass and the Pit and Scars of Dracula, and he had just gotten off Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde, which is one of my favorite Hammer films. He had just finished that. Block had written the novel Psycho, on which the film directed by Alfred Hitchcock was based. The film was shot in April 1972, premiered in the UK on the 6th of July 1972, in North America on November 17th, 1972. The framing story has Dr. Martin arriving in a secluded asylum for the incurably insane. He should begin there in a new appointment as a doctor, but first gets interviewed by the authoritarian warden Lionel Rutherford, the great Patrick McGee. But if you watch The Clockwork Orange, he's the guy that gets that giant ceramic penis knocked into his head when as he's getting kicked around while Malcolm McDowell and his troops are singing in the rain. Rutherford is in a wheelchair and blames this on the attack by a patient. He declares a lack of hope for any improvement in any of the patients. As part of the interview, Rutherford challenges Martin to identify from among the inhabitants Dr. B. Starr, a former head of the asylum who underwent a complete mental breakdown. Dr. Martin is to interview one by one of the patients. If his deduction is correct, Rutherford will consider him qualified for the post. So, yeah, that's basically your frame story. The previous doctor who was running the asylum is now a member of the asylum. And if you could figure out which one it is, then you're qualified to work here. And that's a hell of a way to set up a framing story. We'll cut to the trailer right now. We'll be back in a moment.
Come to the asylum. Come to the asylum to get killed. to the asylum.
Yes, I think the time has come to take violence toys away from him.
To get killed. Come to the asylum. To get killed. Asylum.
Now you hurry and get dressed, and I'll go down the hall and,
Asylum, starring Peter Cushing, Britt Eklund, Herbert Lom, Patrick McGee, Barry Morris, Barbara Parkins, Robert Powell, Charlotte Rampling, Sylvia Sims, Richard Todd, James Villiers. Asylum. Asylum. The most exciting film you'll ever see.
And welcome back to Literary License Podcast. We're discussing Asylum from 1972. And let's start with you, Keith. What are your thoughts on Asylum?
I think Asylum works very, very well. I actually liked it. I like the idea of the different mental patients and their different stories. I mean, there are a couple. I mean, Barbara Parkins from Valley of the Dolls is good seeing her again. I've only seen her in Valley of the Dolls. So that was quite good. I think it had a good cast of characters and stuff like that. I liked all the stories. You know, it's a shame that Jesus wasn't able to resurrect at the end of the movie, but, you know, what can you do? So,
I think I think of is the wrapped up body parts trying to get to the guy, the girl on the floor of the leg moving like.
Well, I thought to myself, I was like, whoever wrapped them up did a really good job of wrapping them.
He could have worked in a butcher shop because, I mean, it just did such a wonderful job with it. I mean, you wouldn't even know, you know.
But if he like had the little hands and like you could see like the little nails.
It's just the leg, though. The leg just coming across the floor, like, you know.
I mean, I like the story, but I did find it slightly laughable because I thought to myself, I was like, if that happened to me, I don't know if I would scream, be scared, or I just would burst out laughing because of the coming up.
Well, I mean, how are you going to be scared? I could outrun every body part in there. I mean, the head is just like right there.
You know? Just kick it like a football.
I know. It's just like, why is she tripping balls? It's like, start beating ass. You get out of there. They ain't moving fast.
It took a while to get moving as well. Like, gee, that's funny. Bruce Legg never moved like that before when she was alive.
I know. Then you got the hand, the arm, because he wraps the fingers too. I mean, he individually wraps everything in his body parts.
The wrapping.
Why isn't she back in the freezer? Why is she out of the freezer? It's like, put her back.
I would personally bring that guy. I would personally take in that guy. And I would have saved his life so he could wrap my Christmas presents every year.
No shit.
He's a fantastic wrapper.
He wrapped perfectly. I mean, did you see the head? The head was perfect.
I know. The thing that guy could do with butcher paper is beyond. he's a pure master of the craft.
Definitely. He probably worked in a butcher shop.
And we were talking about the House of Long Shadows that all the horror stars and Desi Arnaz Jr. This is the guy that plays the publisher that sends Desi Arnaz to the house. That was this actor. And man, I really should have prepared and not been using my phone for the podcast because then I could look things up a lot easier. But yeah, that would be Frozen Fear.
But I really like that story a lot. I mean, it was fun. It's kind of stupid, but it was still enjoyable.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, this is one of those stories. I think they revisit and do a similar story to this in Vault of Horror later on. So you kind of then by that point, you kind of start to see the repetition also. But yeah, I think this is a strong story, too. A strong opening.
The next story I liked a lot, The Weird Tailor. I love that one.
Oh, I didn't understand. Okay, so Cushing doesn't have money for the suit, but he tells this guy to make the suit without intending to pay for it. Is that what we were dealing with? Because I mean, the guy needs rent, obviously, for the bully landlord.
Yeah, But it was also bringing his son back to life.
Yeah, the guy at the casket.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's spending all his money to bring his son back. That's the...
But that doesn't help the guy making the soup, though.
But his son didn't die in a very nice-looking way, did he? I mean, he was quite weird-looking. He looked like he was kind of deformed.
It's the way they had him in the casket, though, I think.
Well, he looked like he died from fright then or something. I don't know. But however he died, it didn't look like it was pleasant.
No, they definitely not.
Say, so, why does she put that thing on the mannequin knowing it's a magic suit and she puts it on a mannequin? I just, you know.
I don't know. I mean, she seemed a bit simple, but
yeah, I was going to say, I don't know that she knows that it's a magic suit. I don't know. It's not totally clear to me.
I'm just saying that if your business is going through a really hard time, you might not want to put that in the window, that suit. I'm just
saying. It's an ugly suit, too. It's not even an attractive suit.
No, I thought to myself, like, it looked like one of, it kind of looked like Elvis Presley's on tour in Hawaii suit kind of thing. I had to come like the high collar here.
Yeah.
Da-da-da, da-da-da.
Yeah.
Da-da-da.
We could also kind of see the, you know, the understanding that we had. This obviously was a tailor who was successful for a long while because he was talking about the clientele that he used to have. And he used to have these high class clients. And I don't know if it's the area has now downturned.
See, I think that they could have made more use of it because in the 70s, we get the department store and ready-made clothing. And I think they could have put a more of a nod towards that to make more sense of it.
Yeah.
You know, that because people don't go to tailors anymore. Now they go get their pre-made suits now. And then they just get them hemmed up or suited, but no one gets suits made from scratch anymore.
Right.
So, and I'm probably filling that story in for myself, but it would make sense because apparently he's still very good at his craft. So
he must be, yeah.
So the question basically is why is he not doing the business? But if they put that little thing about, you know, department stores, you know, like, you know, a bit like, you know, grocery stores, you know, killed the butcher and killed the greengrocer, you know, that kind of thing, you know, maybe. But I think it would have made a bit more sense.
I'm seeing it now with that, with Amazon kind of killing the brick and mortar stores too.
Oh, God, yeah. The big box stores killed the little mom and pop stores a long time ago.
Yeah, I mean, that's what's going to happen. Things are going to come along and they're going to wipe out the old way of doing things.
With the 70s, so that would make a lot of sense.
And we also had the very specific timeline that Peter Cushing needed Bruno to make the suit in.
Right.
Because it's all to do with witchcraft and magic, and you got to do these during this certain hour. So Peter Cushing's part in this one was not that big, actually. Now that I think of it,
But he had that same pathetic character that he had in Tales from the Crypt, which is kind of sad.
Yeah, I mean, this is after his wife's death. So yeah, this is that's where we are at this point in time. That his wife died in between the making of these two movies. So yeah, but he's again playing a grief stricken man. I think we only have one more Peter Cushing movie in the Amicus movies, and that's going to be a completely different thing from what we're used to with Peter Cushing in these movies. I think there's only one left because he's not in Vault of Horror.
Well, he goes to Star Wars after that. He plays Grand Moff Tarkin.
That's still, at this point, that's still
77, right?
Yeah, that's 5 years away still.
Yeah, true. But he wasn't done yet. I was trying to think of what I seen him in after this.
He was still working in Hammer Films. He was still working in, you know, your random horror movies. He's working a lot in television. What was the... He was in the Zucker Brothers movie with Val Kilmer. I don't remember the name of it. God, what was it? The comedy making fun of like spy movies.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
I cannot think of the name to save my life right now.
Val Kilmer is in it?
Yeah. Top Secret.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's Top Secret. So he's in that.
Is that where they got the rockets and they're thick? Yeah. They got all those big rockets. Top Secret. You're right.
Yeah, that was the one. He almost wound up in Halloween, but I think he had a scheduling conflict because the original people Carpenter wanted for Loomis were Christopher Lee, who turned it down, Peter Cushing, who I think he was making Star Wars, and that's why he couldn't do Halloween. I think he was working on Star Wars, or it might have been something else that where he had a conflict. Because he made it clear, if you offered him a part at that time, he was going to take it if he had the time for it, just because he wanted to get away from home and get out of the house and all that stuff. But yeah, you'll see him. You'll see him in quite a few movies after this, still. But yeah, there's only one more official Amicus movie in his chamber. That's going to be From Beyond the Grave, which we'll cover soon. I think it might even be next month. But yeah, he's playing the same kind of grief-stricken, almost pathetic character here. Who he just wants to bring back his dead son. So you do kind of get, and he's apparently had a fortune, and he has basically blown this whole fortune
to figure out how to make the suit.
Yeah, which, you know, you totally understand. The tailor, though, I kind of feel like, yeah, he fell behind on his rent, but what did he really do?
Not much. I mean, he seems like a big irresponsible baby. He doesn't want to pay his bills.
Maybe. He does kill Peter Cushing at the end of this segment, so that's why he's in the. And then he's talking about, oh, it's the suit. So yeah, there's that. As far as the wife putting the suit on the dummy, I don't know. I don't think they make it clear. What did she know what she was doing? I don't know.
No, I think she's just. I think she's just. They made. I think for her, I think she just. He's made this nice suit, and she just put it on the dummy because he. What else are you going to do with it?
Well, she said she wanted to display it, I think, is when she
precisely, yeah.
Well, there must have been something else they could have done with that suit, because it probably could have gotten quite a bit of money. It looks like they had some kind of, yeah, the material must have been worth something. But yeah, by that point, you'd already killed Peter Cushing, so what else are you going to do? The next story is Lucy Comes to Stay, and this is Roy Ward Baker's favorite story of this movie.
Charlotte Rampling looks like a 14-year-old in this.
She's really young in this, yeah.
She's wicked young in this.
Well, even Brett Eklund looks really young in this as well. And the thing is like, I don't know. It's kind of bizarre.
She looks extremely young in it, too. They're both, like, I wonder how old they were in this.
I don't know.
Charlotte Rampling was, like, I think in her mid-20s. I think Brett Eklund was about 30 by this point. Brett Eklund...
For a second, I was wondering if they were gay in this, too, because were they sending out gay vibes? Guys?
There's implications of that. Yeah, I felt that, too. Britt Eklund was exactly 30 when this movie came out. Charlotte Rampling was... Charlotte Rampling was...
22.
Because, I mean, if you look next year when she does The
26. Winter...
She looked a hell of a lot more mature, Britt Eklund.
Yeah.
So...
I'm never going to argue
figure out if they
with
Britt
Eklund dancing around naked, spanking herself, though. So watch The Wicker Man.
Oh, who doesn't love The Wicker Man?
And I'm talking about the original, not the Nicolas Cage version, although that's
no,
that's
I'm great talking for about Peter reasons. Harris. Yeah.
That's great for different reasons. That's a complete schlock fest.
Peter Harris is the best version.
I mean, Rampling looked like Helen Hunt and Jodie Foster had a baby.
Yes.
Kinda.
And she's actually, I love that she's had quite a career herself. So she's still working today. She's in Dune. So yeah, she's still around, still doing high quality work for the most part. So
she's stunning, Charlotte Rampling. So
I absolutely love what I think one of the best actresses alive today. She was in her 20s in this. She's got to be pushing 80 by now.
Easy.
I mean,
I saw her,
she was a Georgie girl in 1966, though.
Apparently, I didn't know this. And I got to rewatch A Hard Day's Night. That was apparently her first movie was A Hard Day's Night. But she's in an uncredited role, so she's probably just like one of the girls dancing somewhere.
78 now.
She's 78, yeah. So like I said, yeah, you got to be pushing. Yeah, she was born in 46, so yeah, it makes sense. She just turned 78 in February. Still doing high-quality work, so good for her, man.
She's a busy woman. She's still busy. She's still kicking it.
She's usually the best thing in whatever I see her in. And let me pull up the Roy Ward Baker.
She's an excellent actress. Definitely.
Let's see here.
Yeah, okay. She was stunning in this. I mean, she was stunning. The first thing I saw her in was Georgie Girl.
I think she's in Dune Part 2, but don't get me the line. I think she's in
I haven't seen either one. I was waiting for the second one to come out.
Yeah, she is. She's in Dune.
Yeah, she's in Dune.
She's in both Dunes.
Yeah. I knew for a fact she was in one. I didn't know she was in both.
They're superior, one of them, or something like that.
So, again, in I Was a Teenage Monster Hunter, Sam Irvin interviews Roy Ward Baker. Sam asks, Hammer's top competitor, Amicus Films, snagged you to do three films for them. Your first one was Asylum from 1972. Did you like it? Yes, in fact, it is one of my favorite pictures that I directed. I have four tales in it, as you know. My favorite was Lucy Comes to Stay. What a cast. Charlotte Rampling and Britt Eklund, both in one segment. Oh, boy. And they were so great. So, yeah, this is apparently
Night Porter is the one that sent her into stardom because she's played that concentration camp survivor that I totally forgot about.
That is an interesting movie. If anyone listening here has never seen it, The Night Porter is a great one. She worked a lot with Visconti, actually. She was in another one of his movies right before this, too. So she did quite a lot with him. But yeah, The Night Porter is fantastic. So yeah, this is one of Roy Ward Baker's favorites of his films. And he also directed, right before this, one of my favorite Hammer films, which is Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde, where Ralph Bates takes the formula and becomes Martine Beswick. It's fantastic. I love it. One of my favorite adaptations. It pulls in the Jack the Ripper story a little bit. And then Roy Ward Baker would later direct one of the first horror movies I ever saw, The Monster Club, which was again from Milton Subotsky. But yeah, this is a pretty strong story. And again, it's Britt Eklund showing up as Lucy, and you don't exactly know what's going on right away. I don't think I did when I first saw the movie, but I first saw this as a teenager. So watching it now, I'm watching it with adult eyes. So I don't remember necessarily what I was thinking when I was watching this at like 15 or 16. It was just a first time watch for either of you. What did you think of the story?
This one, I haven't seen this in eons. I didn't remember the story, but I thought maybe when I first time around, we talked about Lucy Comes to Stay.
Yeah. Were you?
Well, trying to figure out, did she commit the crimes? Did she not commit the crimes? Because they're saying that.
Well, if you committed the crimes, I mean, to be honest, I think we're dealing with
dissociative
voices or bipolar. Someone who's bipolar,
dissociative disorder kind of thing.
Yeah, I think it's that situation. I mean, we don't really know what the Britt Eklund. I don't know if this is, you know, her imaginary friend come to life, or was a girlfriend that didn't work out, or we don't really know the Britt Eklund part of the story. We just know that she's seeing her because she stops taking her medication.
Yeah.
Care of her in some capacity or looks out for her. I thought they were lovers, but
that's the implication that I got, that she may have been a lover while she was away and something happened. Maybe she killed Lucy. Maybe Lucy's dead and this is her way of, I don't think it's necessarily completely clear.
It's not clear at all. That's why I'm asking y'all, because I mean, was it deliberately not clear?
Deliberately not clear is her brother, who looked like he was like 40 years older than she was. That was like, really? It's like, is that her dad or is her brother? Really?
That's what I thought originally, too. I was like, oh, okay. She's coming home to stay with her dad. Oh, no, that's her brother. Okay. Weird.
But I also think that, you know, she was put away anyway. She's coming back home from the asylum. She's on medication. She stops taking her medication. Up pops his alter ego, again, who's a bad influence on Barbara. So, you know, if you look at classic cases like this, you know, they always blame the alter ego, people who have psychotic breakdowns like this. So, you know, and so that I would sit there and say that Barbara or Charlotte Rampling is the one who's doing the killing and is blaming it on this alter ego of Lucy. Now, whether Lucy lived or not, I'm not quite sure here, but normally it's like the inner voice. Sometimes they'll name the inner voice, you know, like Son of Sam naming his inner voice after the dog next door, that kind of thing. So it wasn't you did it. It was the dog who did it. Or in this case, it wasn't me who did it. It was Lucy who did it. I tried to make Lucy stop, but she wouldn't, even though Lucy may never existed ever.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think she, I don't know the dynamics of the relationship. I like to think that it was something where they may have been lovers, like Vicky was saying, and she just kind of lost it when maybe the relationship didn't work out, or maybe she murdered Lucy, and this is, maybe she justified it as Lucy did it to herself. Who knows? Man, this is only four stories, and we're already running through it. So let's go to the final story, which is Mannequins of Horror, which we get some killer dolls in this one.
Was the doll's head the same one that was used in, what's that Puppetron TV movie? I mean, not TV movie, but TV series, the British one.
Oh, God.
Thunderbirds.
Maybe.
It might have been the same head as that was one of the Thunderbirds, or the one that was in Team America.
The mannequin. I don't know if it would have been
little doll.
Maybe the one in Team America might have been inspired by this, because who knows if it would still even be functional.
Yeah.
By the time Team America
had, like, the same head as it's either Team America or it was Thunderbirds or one of those shows, because it had the same head. So I was like, oh, which is Herbert Lom's head, actually.
Herbert Lom, he just looks like a bad guy no matter what. You can't even put that guy in a nice role. He just looks mean.
He was a good guy in the Dead Zone.
Yeah.
Because he was the one telling Christopher Walken.
Yes.
Walken asked if you could go back in time and kill Hitler, would you do it? And Herbert Lom was the one who was like, no, because then you'd create like this ripple. But for the most part, yeah, he's usually the villain. I think in Mark of the Devil, he wasn't the villain either. But I always like him in almost everything I see him in. He's usually one of the best.
He's a good actor.
He's fantastic.
He just plays villainous kind of scary parts.
He was in Lace as well. Which one of you bitches is my mother?
Yeah. What is Frank Forsyth supposed to be doing in this?
You both talked over each other. I have no idea what either one of you said.
Oh, Frank Forsyth. He's just the asylum keeper, isn't he?
Yeah, he's the gatekeeper, and the twist at the end.
Yeah, that twist didn't make a lot of sense to me, but
no, it doesn't. It does. It's still confusing.
Did they do this on purpose? Well, do they want us to stay confused? I mean,
I think it's just like with the M. Night Shyamalan movies now, where his whole thing, his entire career has been that he's got this huge twist at the end of the movie. And by this point, Amicus had to have a twist at the end of the movie. So, okay, what's the twist going to be? It's going to be, well, I mean, the whole crux of this movie is who is actually Dr. God. How am I forgetting the name? Who is
Dr. Brian Byron?
Who's Dr. Byron? So, You gotta have a twist in it, but it doesn't necessarily make sense, but I guess having a twist for the sake of the twist. But I really like the little robots that go through killing Patrick McGee.
The little robot that looks like him.
Yes, with the little Herbert Lom head.
I mean, it really was a really well done robot. I mean, it looked. The eyes, everything. I mean, they had it down.
Yeah, the different animatronics.
It was a creepy little thing. God, that's creepy looking.
Yeah, the different animatronics they used in this movie were pretty good. Even going back to the first story with the moving body parts that are
I'm just the leg going across the floor, and then you have the head. Then you got the torso. Coming out like, you know, what was that? Just a flesh wound for Monty Python. It's just a flesh wound. That's all it kept reminding me of. It's just like, God, this is so bizarre. And I mean, she could have outrun all that shit. I mean, it's not like they were going fast. The body parts.
Yeah, but then what's the fun in that? We need to have,
I know she was locked in the room. I mean, to be honest, at the end of the day, it was the It's the arm that came out of the air conditioning box that actually got her in the end. So
yeah,
it didn't kill her. It just scratched her. Then what, did the police show up and break down the door and thought that she killed everyone, I guess? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that's, because then she's in the asylum the next time we see her.
I mean, I do enjoy this movie, but I do think you can't think about it too much.
No, you got to let it, what you always say, wash over you, so to speak.
Yeah.
Because you're going to find, I picked out a few things in here I just didn't get. And I was trying to, maybe this is what they do. Because it wasn't a bad film. I mean, it was scary. I mean, I enjoyed it immensely. But I mean, I always kept saying, what did I miss? And there was a lot of that. You know, I was having a blonde moment, a brunette moment, wherever you want to say.
Yeah, I mean, the ending doesn't make any sense at all. At all.
Oh, I think that was their purpose, right?
Basically, he's the mad doctor. And he's having these other doctors come in to take visually his job so he can kill them.
Right.
Yeah. At some point, it's got to get figured out.
Yeah.
At some point, you got to send in a SWAT team.
Yeah.
Like, people keep going for these interviews that are not never coming home.
What was his purpose? Was to suck these people into killing?
Well, I guess he became as crazy as the patients he was treating.
Yeah.
I was left holding a lot of what I don't get, you know? So I figured, okay, the boys will fill it in for me in the podcast, but I don't get it. But you guys are helping me, so you didn't get it either.
I mean, it did. I like the stories and I did enjoy it, but I mean, the ending is a bit forced. Yeah. I like the idea that they were all in asylum this time. And I like the idea that, you know, they were, you know, they're not all dead. I like that idea. And I do think it's probably like, well, the House of Drip Blood did well, so we can do the same thing again without probably greater stories. But saying that, I mean, they do work. The stories do work.
They work.
But
yeah, none of these are really more.
You know, it's a bit like Twilight Zone. They're not the A tier of the Twilight Zone. They're more the B tier of the Twilight Zone stories. But they still.
Well, I like to follow. At least I like to know what I'm watching. I mean, like I said, for these particular films, you got to stop them. You can't leave the room. I mean, I kind of fell asleep one night and I had to turn back on Asylum because, oh, crap, I fell asleep. But then I realized I had to back up to watch like half of the movie again so I could find my place, because you will not understand the story if you miss too much of it. That was the only thing. Usually I know what's going on, like the soap opera with movies, I can figure it out, but this one I had to watch.
It's also kind of odd because the movies themselves, especially in England when they're coming out, any horror movie would get an automatic X rating. The movies themselves are kind of almost childlike in the way they're put together almost in a way that like even a child would be able to understand it. Or in the end of Asylum, it's kind of just like a throwaway, almost like they were seeing it as like, okay, this is like basically kids shit anyway, so it doesn't matter if the ending makes sense because our audience isn't going to care anyway. So you kind of wonder why, knowing that these movies were going to be made for an adult audience, why they didn't put more care into the twist. I don't know why. It felt like it was a twist.
Did it seem rushed? I mean, were they rushed to get production done?
I mean, the thing is that set was probably the asylum itself was probably the most expensive part of this movie, because I can't imagine you're paying that much to anything else, and you're using, God, what is the theme? The theme is a public domain theme. What's it called again? Night of the Bald Mountain?
Right.
Using that as your theme, so you're not paying for music except for somebody to orchestrate it, so you're not paying for the rights.
Which one was using a lot of Wagner? Was it this one or was it the other one? That was Asylum. It was using Wagner.
I mean, this and Tales from the Crypt both, you know.
Yeah.
And then
I just didn't remember any of this because I hadn't seen it in like 30, 40 years. That scares me.
Then when we get to From Beyond the Grave, I think they again use classical music over the intro.
I love it. I think it.
I think that's just Subotsky's way of cutting costs.
Well, it does cost the picture as you're kind of going into it as well. So
yeah,
it's like, do you know, It kind of sets the mood, I have to say. It does a good job of doing that.
Well, yeah, I mean the theme itself is kind of chaotic when you listen to it.
Yeah.
So yeah, like I said, this time period where it's House of Drip Blood, this movie, and Tales from the Crypt, I feel like that's like kind of the peak of Amicus. And then, like, not that I dislike, I think we only have two more official Amicus movies, at least.
Right.
Because I think we're doing the Monster Club, but that's not officially an Amicus movie.
That's the movie I was trying to think of, Monster Club. So that's not Amicus.
No, it's Milton Subotsky, though, behind it. But it's not officially Amicus because
not the same studio.
Yeah, it's Milton Subotsky on his own. He and Max J. Rosenberg had a falling out after, I want to say, after one of the dinosaur movies. It's either At the Earth's Core or one of those. They had a massive falling out. But we talked about it when we were covering. Fuck, which one were we covering? We're covering one of them where I went through an interview with Milton Subotsky and he was talking about the downfall of Amicus. And it might have been during Tales from the Crypt that we were talking about it, because I think that's when the things started kind of breaking a little. Oh no, it was during the Uncanny. While we were doing the Uncanny, we were talking about it, his falling out with Max J. Rosenberg, because we noticed with the Uncanny it was a lot cheaper than these movies, because these movies, you know, Tales from the Crypt, they sold to 20th Century Fox and they basically made their money back on that. Dr. Terror's House of Horrors in the United States is distributed by Paramount. So you the early movies, you'd have like these major studios picking them up, and Subotsky and Rosenberg would get their money back. But the money started to not trickle in as much. I think Subotsky and Rosenberg started having fallings out over the money, and over Rosenberg bringing in other people, and Subotsky feeling like, why are you bringing in these other people? Like, Amicus, it's Latin for friendship.
Right.
Like, we're friends. That's the whole point of this. And I think he felt kind of betrayed. And we'll get to that later on, because there's still a couple of movies left. I know there's only two more anthologies left that we have to cover from the studio. But you could already kind of start to see the cracks by the next one we're covering. And then, you know, From Beyond the Grave, which I love as a movie, and I cannot wait to get to that one. It's another one of my favorites. It's a very good anthology movie, but I gotta go through my books, and it's been a little while for me. I gotta go back through my books and see if that might have been one that wasn't as financially successful. The Warner Brothers bought it in the United States, so I wonder if it's something later on that caused the actual downfall. But yeah, we'll get into the nuts and bolts of all that in the next couple of movies. So I guess we'll rate Asylum. Vicky, what are your thoughts?
I'm going to give it a 4.5 just because it's got some of my favorite people in it still. And because I think that the stories really work and they're really intriguing. And it's, I think that they've got some comedy to go along with the horror, but it works. You know what I mean? The comedy doesn't detract from the horror, and the horror doesn't detract from the comedy. So, I mean, it kind of, they put it together rather well. It just, the one thing about it is if I didn't pay attention, you know, because y'all know I'm ADHD anyway. But I mean, I had to pay attention to these films for the most part. They're just not ones that I could turn my head away. I would sort of like watching Dark Shadows. I could never not been able to watch that without a VCR back in the day. Because if you missed one, you miss the whole thing. You snooze, you lose kind of thing. But I thought all the stories worked. I thought they were great stories.
I absolutely agree. Keith?
I'm giving it 3.5 because I think it's a point below the last one. But I still enjoyed it. You know,
I just gave it the extra point because of the guy wrapping up that woman's parts in beautiful brown paper. I mean, he wrapped her up. That I wish I could do a job like that.
I just wish there was a little bit more cohesion at the end. The end of it kind of.
I can get the end. I will say.
The end of it kind of ruined it. I think that if they thought through the ending a little bit more, I would have given it 4.
I would have given it more if I understood the ending, but I thought that was the whole point. They want to keep us guessing. I thought that's what was going on. So.
I don't think they thought that far ahead. I think they just thought, let's put in a twist because people expect a twist.
Yeah.
So. It was a twist.
For myself, I think I'm going to go 4.5 instead of the 5 I gave House of Drip Blood because, again, yeah, I think the ending is kind of nonsensical, and I think that warrants. I think when you botch the ending, you got to have a 0.5-star taken off at least. But yeah, otherwise, I love this movie. And again, I don't know if it might be with me nostalgia because this is a movie that, you know, the first time I rented it, I fell in love with it immediately. Although I don't think the stories are as strong as The House of Drip Blood, but they're all still strong. I could have used more Peter Cushing, but he was committing himself to so many movies at this point. Who knows how many? That might have been.
Who knows? How many movies has he been in?
A lot, especially during this time period. This is just after his wife passed away and he was just drowning himself.
He's got the big eye.
Be honest.
That was the Val Kilmer one, Top Secret.
Yes, okay, yeah. It is. Oh my God, because I always remember the big eye.
I mean, the Peter Cushing story, I mean, why didn't he just take a deposit to begin with?
That's true too, yeah.
Bad for him though, this time. He really loved his wife. I watched that documentary about the Cushing Rose. That was a very interesting documentary.
I mean, that's the reason why it kind of took a point off this or a star off this is only because there's little things like that. This is like, all they have to do is like throw in some, you know what I mean? Just flush them out a little bit better. That's all. So,
yeah. Yeah. Had he gotten a deposit on the suit before he spent all that time making it and promising.
Oh my God, I know. But
promising his landlord or the wife.
He slipped off that other guy though. The landlord was an asshole. The guy that made the suit was an asshole. The Cushing is an asshole for not paying the guy to pay his rent. Everybody was an asshole.
But my whole thing is, so he blew his whole fortune on this book to bring his son back to life, and he's, you know, getting this really expensive suit made. How is bringing his son back to life gonna pay for the suit?
I guess he just wasn't thinking. He just wanted his son back.
He wanted his kid back. I totally get that, but I wasn't gonna. Let's see. My son knows where the treasure is buried, and that's why I got to bring him back.
Yeah, well, that would make more sense.
Well, another thing is that we've seen how the suit brings the mannequin back to life. So God knows what state the sun's going to be and when he gets brought back to life.
And then they put the thing on the mannequin instead. You know, you can tell the mannequin's going to be all kinds of boobar coming to life.
It'd be like Tales from the Crypt with the wife with the monkey's paw episode or segment wishing her husband back to life. He's like, what? He's already been embalmed.
Yeah.
Then she tries to cut him up. Wait, no, you wish that he would live forever. So now he's just going to be in agony for all eternity.
I know. That was so inopportune, wasn't
it? That poor guy.
Oh my God, he's going to be suffering for eternity in pieces.
Still suffering now.
That was a gruesome but great story, I have to admit.
And that was the same year as Asylum. So yeah, this is like I said, this is these movies are like the peak of it. And then you're going to start to see the downturn. But so far, I think of all of them, I think Torture Garden's probably the one I rank the lowest, while House of Drip Blood and Tales from the Crypt are the two that I rate the highest. And we'll see as we go on with these. So yeah, I guess we'll throw it back to Keith and he'll let you guys know on everything else that's going on right now. Take it away, Keith.
Well, this brings us to the end of the Literary License Podcast. Next month is Dark Fantasy Month. We'll be covering films based on dark fantasy. We'll be springing that off with Book to Scream with our Once Upon a Time feature dealing with The Witches by Roald Dahl and the film The Witches from 1990.
Batman the Animated Series will continue with Harley's Holiday, Make 'em Laugh, Lock Up, and Deep Freeze. And Dark Families will continue with The Black Cauldron from 1985 and The Spiderwick Chronicles from 2008. And Anthology will be continuing with The Vault of Horror from 1973 and From Beyond the Grave from 1974. So that's good night for myself and good night, Vix. Good
night, guys.
Good night, Joe.
Good night, everyone.
And see you next week for The Witches.
After 70 years, it's what he goes there for, is to unlock the door. All those around him criticize and sleep. And through a fractal on a breaking wall, I see you, my friend, and touch your face again. Miracles will happen as we dream. Together they were friends at school.